BCFM 93.2 is a charity run entirely by volunteers. That means we are not for profit, so we can put you, the people of Bristol, first. BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
Welcome back to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. After the humiliation and chaos of Cyprus, what would a major euro-dollar crash look like? Will there be cash in the tills and food in the supermarkets? Will savers lose everything? We take you through two likely doomsday scenarios and look at the events which might trigger it in the first place. Plus, a former Scotland Yard detective got a sinister and frosty response when he submitted his evidence to the Parliamentary Commission on Banking. Who is he, and why didn't they like the cut of his jib? Plus, always on the hunt for a good conspiracy that will stand up, we take a look at the cult US show. It's a compelling synthesis of the ITV's old Cook Report, which got taken off the air in 2000 after 4 weeks of lies from Rupert Murdoch's News of the World, and the US series The X-Files. Former US State Governor Jesse Ventura and his conspiracy theory show has been looking at how to assassinate people within the US and the West and make it look like death by natural causes. Plus, we hear from Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's British wife, Asma, and Martin Summers takes us on his weekly tour of the world's hotspots. But first, though, a former Scotland Yard detective got a sinister response when he submitted his evidence to the Parliamentary Banking Commission, and he joins me on the line now. That's Rowan Boswell-Davies. Hi, Rowan, and welcome to Drive Time.
It's great to be with you.
OK, first of all, can you just tell us a bit about your background, where you worked and, you know, what your job was?
Yeah, I'm a lawyer, actually, by training, never really fancied it, having qualified. So I joined the Metropolitan Police, and I spent some time in the Met, and I was very quickly, because of my legal qualifications, I was very quickly sent to Scotland Yard, and I was sent to the Fraud Squad. So I spent most of my career, early career, as a detective, investigating major investment frauds, both in the securities markets but also the futures and derivatives markets.
And can you just give us an idea of how long you spent in there and what kind of cases you dealt with?
Well, I was at the Yard in all for 12 years, and the kind of cases that I dealt with were major investment frauds, people who were being inveigled to invest money in schemes and plans which, frankly, they didn't really understand, I think it has to be said. But they were being conned. That's the great skill of the con man. They were being conned into believing that they did understand it and were parting with significant sums of money to invest in copper futures and wheat and, what we call soft commodities. But really, the whole thing was the scams. The futures contracts were never actually ever being bought, and they were being completely bamboozled as to what was happening with their money. And then eventually, the wise guys would just sort of come along and say, "Well, look, we're terribly sorry, you lost all your money. It's a shame, but would you like us to go? Because we think we could go back and try again." You'd be amazed actually how many people actually did have another go second time round to try and recoup their money, and of course they lost. They lost all that as well. It was that kind of stuff I was engaged in.
Now, it sounds to me a little bit like a gambling casino, but even in a casino, there have to be rules. I wonder, what the regulation was in the 1980s when you were working at Scotland Yard in the Fraud Squad.
Oh, no, there were none. There were none whatsoever. The city regulated itself. The only real controls that existed before the huge regime we've got today, the only rules that really existed were the rules of the club. It used to be said that the city was regulated by the height of the governor of the Bank of England's eyebrows. That if the governor of the Bank of England didn't like something, his eyebrows would go up, and you would measure his sense of displeasure by how high his eyebrows went. I mean, I know that's a sort of apocryphal story, but in a funny kind of sense, it kind of brings an air of verisimilitude to really the lack of any formal regulatory controls. I mean, there was some control was brought by a pretty feeble government department called the Department of Trade and Industry. But apart from that, if things went pear-shaped, it was generally left to us in the fraud squad to try and sort out.
So the idea really was, are you saying even back in the 1980s, that it was about a company's reputation and a particular dealer, a trader's reputation, that if they had a reputation for losing money, then people wouldn't follow them in the future? Is that about the long and short of it?
Well, in a way, yes. I mean, you could say that. But you see, what you got to realise is that the rules of the city and the way the city plays the game are entirely different for the people in the know, as opposed to the people they want to actually take the money from. The way the city regulated itself in many respects was that everybody expected that there would be some skullduggery, and A would steal from B one day, and B would steal from A the next day. But as long as nobody moaned and whined about it, and the whole thing was kept within within the square mile, within the rules of the club, everybody kind of understood that that was the way things were done. But you also went out of your way to look after your fellow practitioners. So that's why we used to say it was a very clubbable atmosphere. But it was a very different attitude altogether towards the outsiders whom they wanted to attract to become the investors, if you like, and those people never got a fair suck of the sauce bottle at all. But they themselves would never have really known what the reputation of the people they were dealing with who were inviting them to come and invest, because of course the chaps that were doing all this, well, they looked sort of absolutely puckered gentlemen. They looked the real part, and they were very sophisticated in their skills in conning people. So I doubt very many losers who actually lost much money really bothered themselves about the reputation of the guy that was offering to look after their money.
So were the fraud squad actually clubbable? Were they part of this little club in the square mile? Because it doesn't sound like there's a lot of room for you.
You're joking. No, we were feared. We were absolutely feared in those days. In fact, we got better and better at what we were doing once we learned the rules of the game and suddenly started to see the kind of things that were going on. Because you see, in my day, we were part of the new breed that was brought in by Sir Robert Mark to try and clean up the mess that the old Metropolitan Police had been in. There was a time when, I'm sure your listeners will be familiar with it, there was a lot of corruption within the old Metropolitan Police, the old CID, back in the 50s and 60s. And Sir Robert Mark brought a whole new breed of a new generation of young detectives into the force to try and make a difference. I was part of that new breed that came in. So we were very keen to show well and to do well. And what we started to do, we stopped playing by the city's rules. We stopped dealing with them as gentlemen, and we treated them as criminals.
So what were the city's rules, though, Rowan?
Oh, well, you know that if you wanted to interview, a particular man, you'd ring up his solicitor, and you'd invite him to come in, and you'd say, well, could you please bring Mr. Smith in to see me at the fraud squad in 3 weeks' time? And it was all terribly gentlemanly, because these men were used to being treated like this. They were used to being treated with kid gloves, because there was an immense degree of, in my view, totally misplaced so-called respect for the city types, you know, because there was this concept that they were gentlemen. Well, we stopped playing by those rules. We started treating them the same way we would treat South East London villains. And we started kicking their doors in at 4 o'clock in the morning and dragging them back to Holborn Police Station and locking them up in exactly the same way as we would treat any other respectable villain. And it had a remarkable effect, because we started charging them, instead of dealing with them in the way the old DTI used to, you know, having long drawn-out trials arguing about how many angels could dance on the head of a pin, we started charging them with ordinary offences of theft and false accounting and obtaining property by deception. Old criminal offences under the Theft Act. And they really, they absolutely hated having that done to them. Because what it meant was that when they were convicted, it meant that they were completely cast out of the city. They couldn't go back, because they were now marginalised as being criminals, and they could never actually go back to their old stamping grounds again. And so there was actually, for a period of time, there was a great deal of fear on the part of a lot of these people. And in fact, I think, I'm not sure whether you're familiar with the case called the Blue Arrow case.
Yeah, we were discussing it last week, yeah.
Oh, well, sorry, there we are. I'm right behind you then. Well, in the Blue Arrow case, that was a case where some really blue-blooded city bankers, I mean, these guys were right out of the top drawer, and they were prosecuted for one of the old-fashioned city offences of a form of market manipulation. And they were convicted. Lengthy trial, but they were convicted. And the effect of that upon these princes of the city was that suddenly overnight their reputations were literally pulled from underneath them. I think, frankly, society, I think the establishment was so shocked that this could happen to them that they almost rushed into an appeal process. An appeal process which was so unusual by the terms of the time, because what they did was they allowed their appeal. Normally when an appeal goes forward, the only thing that a defendant can appeal against, he can appeal against the way the judge summed up to the jury, he can appeal against the interpretation of the law. What he can't appeal against is the fact the jury found him guilty, because the juries are the finders of fact. But what happened in the Blue Arrow trial was that they actually found that the jury could not have come to a reasonable verdict because of the length of time the trial had taken. And for me, that was almost unheard of at the time. But when it was all over, and when the dust had settled, a friend of mine from the Serious Fraud Office, a very close friend of mine at the Serious Fraud Office, rang me up. And he said to me, well, mate, that's it. The message has come down from on high. We're not going to have any more major criminal trials against the blue bloods in the city, because it's all too embarrassing, and they just can't cope with it. And so we've been told in future these kind of trials, we're just not going to have them anymore.
So in your situation, I mean, did you see a change whilst you were working at Scotland Yard, and a reaction, a kickback at the time when you were kicking people's doors down? Did you find that they kicked back at the time, or did it take all the time until the early 90s, I think it was, when they had this Blue Arrow trial appeal?
Well, it took them some time to get used to the fact that there was a squad of, detectives who weren't prepared to pay them the kind of respect that they felt they were owed. But the pushback, I think the pushback really came when because the people we were dealing with were not, it has to be said, were not a socially elevated as the Blue Bloods in the County NatWest case. So I think that was what really shocked the establishment back in the 90s. But there was a very definite pushback as far as the establishment was concerned. And of course, you see, what you must bear in mind is that by the time the Blue Arrow trial came on, of course, the city then had created a whole form of convoluted so-called self-regulation. And we'd been through the era of Big Bang, when all the rules changed, so that now we theoretically had a whole regime of regulatory conduct in the city, which was supposed to make things better. I mean, it didn't. I mean, it just everything carried on in exactly the same way. But it was supposed to make things better. So really and truthfully, I think that one of the reasons they felt confident that they could say, well, we're not going to have any more of these kind of trials, is because the establishment felt that they had now implemented a regime of financial regulation which should be given a chance to work properly.
Okay. Now, at the moment, there's this Parliamentary Commission on Banking, which has been taking evidence on banking culture. And I understand you submitted some evidence to that. And this is when in my introduction I said you got a frosty response. Can you just explain what happened?
Well, yeah, as you probably guessed from listening to me, I have a very, very, very strong belief that the only way you can really regulate, particularly an environment like the city where they're dealing with other people's money, the only way you can regulate that is if you find people are stealing that money, then regardless of how they see themselves or their class, you deal with them as potential criminals. And you deal with them in exactly the same way as you would deal with them, say, they were robbing post offices or mugging old ladies in Brixton or Clapham or Peckham or whatever. So, and that's always been my view. I've always taken the view that there should be no social distinction between people who commit crimes in the streets and people who commit crimes in the suites. And so, because I've been watching what's been going on in the sort of whole of the financial regulatory arena for quite a long time now, and becoming thoroughly disgusted with the way in which the Financial Services Authority seemed to be completely incapable of actually doing anything about locking up any of these people who were openly committing criminal offences. So I decided to submit evidence to the Commission on Banking Culture. And what I said to them was that we had whole sectors now of the British banking community which were behaving in ways which were synonymous with organised crime. And I said, we've got areas of banking which are nothing more than organised criminal activities.
Well, I mean, were you able to actually stand that up? Because that's a pretty strong accusation to make. I mean, how do you stand a statement like that up?
It's very simple. I use four definitions of organised crime, which are accepted globally. I use the American model, I use the Australian model, I use the European model, and I use the British model. The definitions of organised crime. And then I looked at the activities of, for example, I mean, what people talk about, they call about mis-selling, PPI mis-selling. You know, you've probably come across this sort of personal insurance.
Yeah, the payment protection insurance, which was designed to, make sure that if you maybe lost your job, you could continue payments.
That's right. Well, what was happening there was that the banks were openly selling products to their clients, but they knew full well they could never, ever use to protect themselves. They knew that, but they carried on selling it. Now, if you sell somebody, if you induce somebody to part with money to buy an insurance policy from you, and you know full well that it will not do the very thing you tell that person it will do when you sell it to them, it's a crime. It's a straightforward offence under the Theft Act.
Now, just to give an idea of perspective, 34 million of these policies were sold, of payment protection insurance. There's been no fine on any of the banks that sold them, and the various banks that did have had to set aside in their accounts £14 billion to compensate people who claim against them.
That's correct. I think the figure now is probably rapidly approaching somewhere in the region of £20 billion in the end.
Sorry, how many? We just missed that.
£20 billion.
Okay.
But the point that I'm making here is, but here you had a consistent policy of conduct of encouraging people in the financial services industry to sell products that they knew were of absolutely no use to their clients. They couldn't use them, and they were selling them and making a vast amount of money out of it by deception. Now, that is fraud. By anybody's definition, that's fraud. And the reason they had to start calling it mis-selling was because the government couldn't suddenly turn round and admit to the rest of the world that there was this 20, you know, whatever the figure is, amount of fraud being committed by financial practitioners in the City of London. Can you imagine the impact that would have had on the reputation of the city? So what they did was they covered it all up with some careful weasel words. They called it mis-selling. But you can take other examples. I mean, for example, look at what HSBC have just been recently hauled over the coals for. You know, openly laundering drug money from Mexico. It's very clear what they've done is they've sat down, thought about how they can make money out of this, and they've made a business case for saying, we'll just ignore the laws on money laundering, we'll actually help them launder the money. Or you can look at the LIBOR manipulation. This was straightforward market manipulation, and there's a perfectly good offence to describe it. It's called false accounting. It's in the old 1968 Theft Act. But these are all straightforward, ordinary criminal offences being carried out on a routine way by people working in these banks with the full knowledge of what they're doing. And that, my friend, is organised crime.
Well, yes, and I mean, there's also the interest rate swaps which are being sold. Apparently, that's a £220 trillion world market. The UK has 90% of its 40,000 swaps have been missold. The banks are setting aside now, this is in the initial stages, only £2 billion for the claims. But again, there's been no prosecution for those. I mean, for example, some of those interest rates swaps were when the loans were being given out. This is also to do with the sorting out the accounts of some of these big banks in the run up to 2008. But there's just some basic figures on LIBOR. Barclays were fined £290 million. RBS were fined £390 million. But this is a massive market. I mean, the estimates are that this is the profits from about 1 week of 1 year of that LIBOR scandal.
Don't forget all these fines. The fines you've mentioned quite properly. These aren't fines in the way that you and I would expect them to be. These aren't the fines that your listeners might seek to have to be, you know, subjected to if they were to, say, I don't know, not pay their television license or something. It's not that kind of fine, because if you and I get into trouble and we go to court and we get fined, the money comes straight out of our own pockets. But in the bank's case, if you think it through, who pays the money when the bank gets fined? It's not the bank. It's the shareholders. It's the shareholders of the bank who actually have to shoulder the pain. Can you shoulder pain there? That's a terrible mixed metaphor.
I mean, actually, Ian Fraser was pointing out last week, Rowan, that actually the share price of RBS when the LIBOR fine was announced, they actually leapt by, I think it was either 5 or 8%. The share price leapt up.
I know, it's called the greater fool principle. But there's one born every minute. I think the reason I suspect that the share price went up was because finally they had actually got if you like, they could draw a line under what was under what had been going on. And I suspect that probably put a bit of false confidence back into the... I mean, the market does things which nobody can understand why it behaves in the way that it does, and I certainly don't understand that.
I mean, the other thing about all this, of course...
What it gives the lie to, of course, is it gives the lie to the old story, which is that when banks commit these kind of offences, that there is a reputational risk issue. It's perfectly clear that there is no reputational risk issue at all, because people are still prepared to keep on doing business with them.
And the other thing, of course, with the Mexican drug money laundering, I mean, incidentally, the Argentinian government is now accusing HSBC of money laundering. But that was all happening under the chairmanship of a certain Lord Green, who was actually made a Church of England reverend back in 1988, and he's now a government minister for trade, you know, for David Cameron.
And he's been asked about it, and of course, he just says, well, you know, I'm not in possession of all the facts, and I'm not in a position to answer these questions. And you're right, it all took place on his watch. But
anyway, can we get back to the Royal Commission on Banking now that you submitted? What did you submit to them? A certain accusation, and how did they receive that?
I submitted a full report. I'm also an academic, and I have an ability to write in a proper concise academic fashion, and I submitted a properly researched, properly referenced academic report on the levels of organized crime going on in the banking sector, how it could be dealt with, how it could be confronted, and I gave them a lot of research evidence showing that actually convicting people, prosecuting city practitioners for these kinds of crimes, actually has a very important knock-on effect, and that it actually does help prevent crime. So I submitted that to them, and I waited to hear from them about receiving, and I kept looking at their website, because what happens with these people is when you submit evidence to one of these commissions, they, if they do nothing else with it, they at least record it. They record the fact they received it, and it is understood that they may not necessarily always use the information that you send to them if they've don't feel it's particularly helpful, but they do at least record it, and I couldn't see any evidence of my work being recorded. So I rang them up and I said, can you tell me what's happening to my report? And the first answer was, well, we haven't received any evidence from you. Well, I knew that was a lie, and I said, well, could you go and check? And they said, yes, we'll check, and they said, oh, we'll ring you back. Well, they never did. So by now I started to smell a big rat. So I rang them again and said, look, can you tell me what's happened to the evidence I've submitted to you? And they said, we haven't received any from you. And I said, look, we've been through this before. You have received evidence from me. Could you please check and come back to me? And they said, well, yes, we will. And of course they didn't. So I realized I was just wasting my time with these people, these civil servants. So what I did was I actually wrote an email to the chairman of the commission, Andrew Tyrie, and I sent it to him and I said, look, I've submitted evidence which I think you might want to know about. I think you at least have the right to decide whether or not you want to see my evidence. I have submitted evidence. I keep being told that they can't find it. I'm a bit concerned about this because I think it's been withheld from you. Now, I didn't get a reply from him, and I didn't expect one, because it would be a bit difficult for him to respond to individual people over this kind of thing. So I wasn't surprised that I didn't hear any acknowledgement from him. However, a week later, I rang the commission again and said about my evidence. And they said, oh, Mr. Wilson Davies, yes, oh, it's remarkable, it's a miracle. Your evidence has just come to light. We suddenly found it. It's all here. It was so risible, I nearly fell off the phone laughing. Because I don't know what's gone on, I don't know what happened, but as a result of my writing to Tari, the next thing I know is they found my evidence. However, they then said, well, we are going to submit your evidence to the commission, but they said, We want to redact. We want to redact it. We want to basically we want to cut out large chunks of it, because there are things you say in this which we think the banks will be offended by. Well, I have to be honest with you. Worrying about offending the banks is the last thing on my mind to worry about at the moment.
Now, also, Rowan, I mean, it sounds fascinating, but I mean, is this submission, is this available online? Can people read it? I mean, because that seems to be the obvious thing to do, is to make sure that not just the Banking Commission have got it, but that it's out there in cyberspace.
Well, it is. I mean, I have put it on my blog.
Do you want to just give us your blog address?
Yeah, it's www.rowans-blog. No, there's no apostrophe in Rowans. rowans-blog.blogspot.com.
Okay, yeah, there's no www, actually. It's just, it sounds like rowans-blog@blogspot.com.
That's it. And it's the last three entries. Because it was too long to put in one chunk, I put it in three tranches. But it's actually on the blog site, and anyone can access it and read it in its entirety.
So now I suppose we've obviated the reason that they might like to redact your... Anyway, I mean, ultimately, what do you think needs to happen in the future? I mean, obviously, this commission is looking at this, but what needs to happen in the future to ensure banks are actually responsive to their clients' needs, respect the wealth that they're investing in these banks, and actually start behaving more responsibly?
I think, for myself, I genuinely believe that how the banks... conduct themselves vis-a-vis their relationships with their clients, at the end of the day, is between them and their client. And if a client doesn't like the way he's being treated by the bank, then it's up to the client, first of all, to say so, and B, secondly, if he's not happy, to move his accounts. I'm not a great believer in the nanny state. I don't believe in too much intervention in these things. It's a commercial decision. And if the commercial, like you, I mean, if you're not happy with the service you get from a commercial provider, you make it known, and you either insist on getting better service or you move your business. That isn't my particular concern. My concern is where banks commit criminal offences, they have got to be dealt with. And those criminal offences have got to be investigated by properly trained and properly qualified people who understand how to deal. The FSA has manifestly failed in its duties and responsibilities, because frankly they don't employ anybody who has any skill or knowledge or ability at investigating crime.
But at the moment all we're getting is out of court settlements.
Of course, and it's quite ludicrous. And it's not teaching the banks not to do it again. I can absolutely assure you that it would only take two convictions of two major city bankers of serious offences, money laundering, breaches of the money laundering regulations, of failing to institute proper controls, proper procedures. There are innumerable offences. It would take two convictions. And why two? Because for the first conviction, the city would just look and shrug their shoulders and say, it's an aberration, it doesn't matter. But the second conviction, coming straight after it, they suddenly realised that the establishment really had started to mean what they said. And then you would suddenly find there would be a gathering rush to start putting their house in order.
I mean, that is a possibility, but I mean, you know, if it doesn't happen, Rowan, what do you think is going to be the consequences? Quite clearly, that would be, you know, quite fascinating and amazing if that did happen. But assuming that things just carry on as they are, where do you see all this leading with all this criminality?
Ultimately, I see it going, if they're not careful, if they continue to allow London to be used as the cesspit for the rest of the world, for the rest of the world's dirty money to come here with impunity, I see it's not beyond the wit of man to see it going the same way as Cyprus eventually in the end. We will just simply undermine our financial systems and so our financial structure so badly it will simply take away any of the important controls and checks and balances that our banking system traditionally relied on. But that's if you like, that's me gazing into the far future, because I think we are different. We would be dealt with differently in Cyprus, but that's a discussion for another time. But my big concern is if they don't change, and they simply don't start bringing these banks into line, breaking them up, making them smaller, ring-fencing the retail arm from the casino arm, doing all the things that they've talked about, then in 5 years' time, you and I will be having this conversation all over again for all the same reasons.
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting hearing what you're saying. It's Martin Summers here, Tony's colleague. I mean, I'm an economist, and I see the consequences of this criminality, and it's systematic. I think it's fairly clear. We're not just talking about individual banks here or individual people. And the Enron effect, everybody copies the bad guys because that's the bottom line. I mean, basically, the problem they've got is if they do carry out genuine investigations with people like yourself who know what they're doing, they'll find that it's all a Potemkin village. And I'm afraid, I mean, Peter Galbraith in the US is an economist. He's the son of J.K. Galbraith. And he's been pushing for this whole idea, we've got to actually send people to prison. We've got to actually clean this up. And in the SNL collapse in the 1980s in the US, thousands of executives were sent to prison. Now, that's not happened this time because the rot's that much deeper. And we've reached a situation where if we arrest anybody, we've got to arrest everybody. We can't arrest everybody, so on we go. But, of course, it's on we go towards crash and collapse.
Well, I fear that. I mean, that is something. I think there is, as you said, there's a systemic issue here. But we have to, it's like everything else, we have to start somewhere. And just as we did in some of the major crimes we had back in when I was at the Yard, eventually you can't possibly, no detective, no law enforcement agency can ever hope to lock up every criminal. But what you have to do is send a message to the constituency that says to them, if you continue to commit these crimes, there's a very, very good chance that you will go the same way as Mr. X, Mr. Y, and Mr. Z. And we have to pick the best case we can to start with, and we have to sort of go to the wire with that one, and then pick the next one, and pick the next one. We can't have all this, my God, like we did with Blue Arrow, or like we did when I was later on as a regulator when I was at FIMBRA, where we started turning over FIMBRA members for wrongdoing, and suddenly the whole organization just panicked because they suddenly saw their friends and their, you know, and their mates suddenly being turfed out of the organization as for not being fit and proper.
Well, Rowan Boswell Davis, it's been fascinating talking to you, and let's hope that those court cases do happen, you know, that we do get some fraud cases of some really serious high-level people, because that certainly will send out a message to the city that they can't play fast and loose with our cash.
I certainly hope so.
So you're just a reminder of your website, it's rowans-blog, with no apostrophe, just rowans-blog at blog, sorry, it's not at, is it? It's .blogspot.com. And thank you very much for joining us on Drive Time this evening.
It's been a tremendous privilege to talk to you, and I really enjoyed it. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you.
Drive Time on BCFM 93.2.
Now, as promised, what would a major euro-dollar crash look like? Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. First of all, I mean, we're looking at a sort of general, a couple of scenarios here, looking at what would trigger it, what would the financial crash actually look like on the day, what would it look like after a few days, after a few weeks, and what would a long-term recovery look like? So, first of all, the trigger, possibly a military incident, maybe real weapons of mass destruction on a city, a nuclear weapon, chemical weapons, biological weapons, possibly, you know, something like a United States aircraft carrier being sunk. But the important thing is this is sending a message around the world of kind of TV pictures of shock.
Yeah, I mean, when we had the crash in 1987, it was pictures of a burning oil rig in the Gulf, which caused the immediate shock. But of course, the fact is that we are on the brink of major wars, and that they do cause crashes. I mean, in the first weeks of the First World War, the stock market collapsed. But of course, the market can collapse under its own steam, as we've just been hearing. With or without a military provocation, it can just collapse anyway.
But I think, you know, what we've been discussing over previous weeks is that, you know, we're building up to a situation, particularly in the Middle East, elsewhere. There's the North and South Korea tension. There's tension between China and Japan. But in any of these situations, it wouldn't take a lot to actually trigger a euro crisis to actually turn into a crash. And that, you know, that's one of the things that has been one of the kind of unintended consequences of this whole euro crisis that's been rolling on the last couple of years, is it's led to a situation where something else might intervene to really tip it over the edge.
Well, there's a whole spectrum of things which could tip it over the edge, and that's why I firmly predict that it will be tipped over the edge, because something or other will turn up and cause it. And it's interesting that you call it a euro dollar crash. Now, that is good, because that actually is the point. It's not about the euro, it's about the banking system. If an individual country, even Cyprus, which is worth 0.2% of European GDP, crashes out of the euro, that will bring credit default swaps, which are owned by banks in Germany and Britain, for example, into play. And at that point, you get a catastrophic failure of the system. This is one of the arguments, for example, against nuclear power. It's a complicated system, and if it breaks down, as we saw at Fukushima, you then get a completely uncontrollable situation. Now, what we've allowed to happen in the financial markets is exactly that. We've been building this bonfire now for 30 or 40 years, piling more pallets on it, throwing more petrol on it, and now, of course, we're striking matches next to it. Now, of course, this bonfire should never have been built. The separation, for example, between retail banking and investment banking was brought in the 1930s in the US, Britain and elsewhere, precisely to avoid this kind of situation. But Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan, the Conservative Party here, the Republicans in the United States, said, oh, no, we don't need that kind of old-fashioned regulation anymore. Why don't we just bring it all into one big bonfire? And, of course, if you bring it all into one big bonfire, that big bonfire can catch fire, and that's the problem.
OK, well, the military incident, one of the reasons I mention it is because it actually would be quite convenient for the financial powers to be able to then say, oh, well, actually, it wasn't our fault, it was the fault of this military incident.
Indeed, and this is why I think we shouldn't concentrate too much on it. You see, Cyprus, for example, is a financial incident, but it's also a military incident, because the Russians are basically being drawn into fighting in Syria. It's the Russians who've got their money in Cyprus, the Russian businesses and the oligarchs and so on who may have lost their money. But of course, Cyprus has got gas, so then they were talking with Gazprom about having some gas, and it's also been hinted that Putin was saying, well, can we have some bases in Cyprus? Now, can you imagine, if the British are kicked out of Cyprus, the Russians put their bases in, ready for the war in Syria. Now, the point is that all of these things are actually working together. The military situation and the financial situation are both on red alert.
Okay.
As we go into the spring of 2013.
Okay, leaving the trigger and looking at the financial crash itself, stock markets would be very quickly, and there would be a kind of contagious collapse because of the electronic nature of these things. There would probably be insider dealing, large amounts of money to be made at this point. Have insiders put their money out of the casino, out of shares and cash, into commodities and property? Well, yes, they have. Lots of money has been going into gold, Hong Kong property, classic cars, fine art, rare coins, stamps, fine wine and jewellery. Markets would be quickly suspended and banks would close their doors almost immediately. Nowadays, that would be almost instantaneous. Cash points would either quickly run out of cash or simply be closed by the banks. Card transactions may be suspended immediately too. That means eventually you can't get at your money. Your savings, can't use it for anything. Food, or for example, to buy a large item like car insurance, tax, your bills, you wouldn't be able to pay them. But the government says don't panic, Corporal Jones.
Well, of course, that's the job. The government's job is to say don't panic, and in a sense you expect them to say that. But the fact of the matter is that they've had 4 years since the 2008 credit crunch to get the house in order. They should have basically, if they're going to prop the banks up, you go in there and kick kick them to pieces, arrest the top people, send them down, take all their money off them, and, you know, you really get a grip on the situation. But we haven't got a grip on the situation. The politicians basically are bought by the bankers, and that includes the left-wing politicians as well as the right-wing politicians. So we've had 4 years of hanging around while they carry on looting. And, of course, what will eventually happen is they will walk away with the loot. But, of course, the society as a whole will then bear the consequences. And I mean, world society will then bear the consequences. And, of course, all of the brushfire wars that are burning out of control will then get a whole slash of petrol on top of them, and off we'll go.
OK, well, we've had a look at the trigger and the financial crash, but what would things be like after a few days? Now, we've identified this as rather a crucial point. Will the authorities get a grip? This is the question. And on the positive side, they could do. What would the government be doing if they did? Well, they would be taking over the banks. There would be maximum daily withdrawals immediately from cash points. National currency controls, probably best set in before the crash. There would be printing and distributing cash to banks to make sure that there was enough available. Food would be distributed. There'd possibly be overprints of the euro notes in other parts of Europe. But on the negative side, there may be an escalation on the military side, false flag attacks and this kind of thing. There may be panic and bad analysis. In other words, a lot of stuff coming through the media, which is really trying to divert the blame for this. Also, state of emergency possibly even coming in quite quickly, even an invasion and war breaking out in the Middle East. On the negative side still, I mean, it may be that there's a long, long time before we can get at any cash. There may be looting and civil unrest quite quickly, possibly even guns on the streets and mob rule. Whereas, you know, in that case, people would immediately pretty much start bartering and sharing things. We may even have the institution of Emergency Powers Act, Martin, and Civil Contingencies Act.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you look at what happened in Argentina in 2001, the banks closed, the Corralito, nobody could get their money out. Basically, people lost their money, as may still happen in Cyprus. And people did start bartering. There was lots of civil unrest. People looted supermarkets. But eventually it led to political change. And the Kirchner administration, the husband rather than the wife, turned around to the IMF and said, you know what? We're not going to pay the money we owe. And you will negotiate with us about how we're going to deal with this, because otherwise we're not going to pay anything and we'll bring down the entire banking system. They had the backbone to stand up to the bullies in Wall Street and London. Now, ultimately, of course, this is what needs to be done, and we need the political will to stand up to these people.
But the ultimate question, I mean, this is the point at which our two scenarios diverge, Martin. We've got the positive one where the government does get a grip, and a negative one where everything starts running out of control. What's your prediction there?
Well, I have to be honest. Basically, I think if you're honest, it's likely that this is going to be way out of control and nobody's going to be able to stop it. But we have to have pessimism of the intelligence and optimism of the will. World wars tend to actually force people to confront reality.
Okay, the next stage is after a few weeks. New currencies would start forming, possibly even currencies like the Bristol Pound might start becoming circulated if there's no cash around. Things like McDonald's vouchers, food vouchers, which are valued at food banks, suddenly these things start to become currency. But then there, of course, would be, after a few weeks, waves of bankruptcies as the banks would be calling in security to try and recapitalise themselves. And many companies going bankrupt, probably apart from the big multinational chains. There would be mass layoffs, mass unemployment, and most people would simply not be able to pay the rent or mortgage. That's when things start getting difficult.
It does, yeah. I mean, what we really need is, as Michael Meach was saying in the first hour, we need a Franklin Delano Roosevelt, which is exactly what Obama should have been. He's been elected twice now. He's the guy that should have been putting all this in place, ready to go. But of course, he's in the pocket of the bankers like they all are, and nothing has been done, which is why it'll probably play out on the negative scenario rather than the positive scenario. The positive scenario required effort to have been made already, and it hasn't been done.
Well, we don't know that. Maybe they have worked on some of this at the Treasury.
They haven't done anything. They haven't done any of the necessary things. I mean, we've just been hearing from our colleague there about the total lack of regulation in the City of London. We've had 4 years to get something in place, and nothing's been done.
Okay, but more long-term recovery. If this is really, we're talking months and years after working with the BRICS countries, doing big building projects, getting people back into work through government spending on infrastructure, building houses. But, I mean, ultimately, it looks like we may have to have a government-run kind of socialist world until private businesses are able to build back up again. Either that, or much of our life will be run by private multinationals.
Now, the problem is that the system is chaotic to the point where it can't survive. Capitalism is going to die. The question is what comes after capitalism. It's a dead donkey. You can beat it with a stick, but it ain't going to get up. And, of course, the powers that be have deluded people for the last 4 years that capitalism's still alive. I've got a secret to tell you. It's not alive. It's dead already.
Well, that's it. You've just heard our question. What would a major euro-dollar crash look like? And you've had a couple of scenarios there. First, with the trigger for it. Secondly, with the actual crash itself. Thirdly, after a few days, what it would look like. Then after a few weeks. Then after a few months. And finally, the Treasury can't say they didn't have a plan. We just broadcast it.
Drive Time on BCFM 93.2.
Now, always on the hunt for a good conspiracy that will stand up, we take a look now at the cult US show, which is compelling synthesis of the ITV's old Cook Report, which was taken off the air by the News of the World, lying over 4 weeks on their front page and inside the paper, that's the Murdoch paper, back in 2000. And the X-Files, a sort of fusion of Roger Cook and the X-Files. Former US state governor Jesse Ventura and his conspiracy theory show has been looking earlier this year at how to assassinate people within the US and the West and make it look by death by natural causes.
Jesse Ventura is on a hunt for a secret weapon, the most dangerous and deadly of them all.
This one was dangerous from the start. I just never imagined how deadly it would all turn out. It began when I got a call to meet Dr. Fred Bell. He's a scientist who's worked on a lot of top-secret government programs. He wanted to tell me that one of those secrets got loose.
The secret beam weapon, a death ray.
A death ray?
Yes.
I think it's going to be used for very destructive purposes.
Now, wait a minute, Doctor. You know, I don't just run off and chase down everything that somebody comes to me. How do you know about this?
I was a NASA rocket scientist when I left that. I became a consultant in the industry, and during that time, I helped develop that ray.
The ray. Doctor, what exactly in layman's terms is a death ray?
The first phase, it's like a microwave that you can direct. It penetrates the surface of your skin and stimulates the central nervous system. It's very hard to detect. It's not like shooting somebody. There's no traces of crime. It's a perfect way for secret government operatives to do wet work.
Wet work? That's CIA talk for assassinations. This death ray comes pocket size.
Now, that's just a little excerpt there from the Jesse Ventura programme Conspiracy Theory, Martin. We don't really get, I mean, it certainly doesn't appear on British television, but, I mean, it's been known, hasn't it, actually, since the Church Committee in the US back in the 1970s, that the American intelligence services have actually put together these weapons. In particular, they showed, back in the 70s, a gun, which actually fired a dart, which would induce an instant heart attack, and it had some kind of way of then dissolving, so that the person would never actually, you know, maybe a doctor or an autopsy would never, no one would ever know. They'd think it was natural.
Well, yes, and Fidel Castro warned Hugo Chavez that they were going to try and assassinate him. And don't forget, I don't think the Americans even deny that they've carried out hundreds of assassination attempts on Fidel Castro, none of which have succeeded because the Cuban intelligence service has been too smart for them. But the idea that they don't go around murdering people is just ludicrous, and nobody in Latin America believes it for a minute. I mean, it's just absurd. It's middle-class, comfy people in their bubble don't realise what the West represents in the developing world. We are seen as the bad guys. And you know why? Because we are the bad guys. Not you and me, but the people in charge of our countries.
I mean, would you say it's go to the extent of assassinating people here? I mean, there's a lot of questions. For example,
well, who killed John F. Kennedy and who killed Martin Luther King? I mean, there was actually a civil case in the US brought by Martin Luther King's family a couple of years ago where they proved to the satisfaction of a jury that he was murdered by the state. And how many other people have been murdered by the state? Most people probably never heard of Fred Hampton, who's one of the founders of the Black Panthers. He was murdered by the state. I mean, if you ask people in Belfast, does the state of Britain go around murdering people? Yes, it does. Brigadier Gordon Kerr used to run the Force Research Unit. He was murdering people indirectly using the Loyalist paramilitaries. Basically, the state is criminal. Now, of course, that gives us an answer, which is we just arrest the criminals and put them in prison. But the state is corrupted by criminal misbehaviour at every level.
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
Now, on to the Palestine issue, and there's Bristol activist Tom Woodhead was arrested recently in a peaceful protest over in Israel, and I interviewed him on last week's Dialect. That's a programme on Fridays on here at 2 o'clock. What was it like being arrested and being taken into custody?
Okay, this was pretty grim, actually. I was beaten around the back of the head, I'm told, by the butt of a rifle, although it could have been anything. I developed a big bruise on the back of my head, a big lump. I was punched in the face twice. I had my head slammed into like a bulldozer that moves barricades from the front of the demonstration. My head was slammed into that. And then not long after that, I was taken into Kerman, into the settlement, where I was blindfolded. The three of us that were arrested, myself and two Palestinians, Bilal and Naif, were put against a wall, blindfolded, hooded, made to look at the ground as the Israeli army loaded their rifles or something like that.
As they loaded their rifles, so you could actually hear the sound of them?
I could hear the sound of loading weapons, probably rifles, maybe tear gas guns. I'm no expert.
So what was going through your mind?
Well, my leg was uncontrollably shaking. There was a brief moment where I thought maybe I wouldn't get out of this situation alive. I soon gathered myself though, really, and realised that this was some sort of mock execution, although I was literally terrified for some time.
Well, that was Tom Woodhead speaking to me last week. Martin, this situation isn't going away in Palestine, is it?
No, I'm afraid not. I'm afraid that all around the world, the haves and the have-nots are about to go to war.
Oh, well, what makes you say that?
Because that's the way of it.
What do you think, there is any possibility of some kind of sorting out this Palestine crisis, though, the situation, the conflict? I mean, this is Good Friday, well, that is the Holy Land, isn't it?
Yes, and of course Obama should have regulated Wall Street, and he should have told the Israelis to do a deal with the Palestinians, but he's done neither.
Well, time to sign off now, but it's just the start of your Friday night talk radio extravaganza. Next week we'll have Asma al-Assad, President Assad's British wife. Thanks very much to our guests. Next week, a follow-up on this week's Teachers Union Conference, also a debate on smart meters. So, our website, thisweek.org.uk. Thanks very much for joining us, and see you next week.
National news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, two sisters are reported to be among three British women kidnapped and raped.